Our clerk will call the first case.
The court will now call Mr. Ramirez versus the state of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. Adam Arrington will argue for the appellant, Mr. Edward Wilkinson will argue for the state.
Madam Justice, and may it please the court, as she just said, I'll be arguing for the appellant, Victor Ramirez, in this cause. As you can tell from our brief, we've raised 7 total points of error on this appeal. This is an appeal from a conviction for aggravated assault upon a public servant and a sentence of 25 years imprisonment. Only the first issue has to do with an error at the trial on the merits. The other 6 points of error all concern the punishment phase of trial, and the 7th point of error is just a cumulative error argument. So we requested oral argument primarily for the purpose of articulating those points of error raised in issues 2 through 6. The facts of this case are not terribly complicated. Basically, our client, Victor Ramirez, was in custody awaiting trial on an unrelated charge. He had suffered an injury to his legs caused during an attempt to evade police capture on that other charge, and he was receiving treatment at JPS when jailers from the sheriff's office came to pick him up and transport him back to the local jail. They secured him to his wheelchair and then secured the wheelchair to the back of a van, and Officer Willie Claiborne of the Tarrant County Sheriff's Department began transporting him back to the jail when he heard some commotion in the back. Our client believed that he had taken a turn too fast and had become basically discombobulated, and Officer Claiborne stopped the van, came around back, and to check on, he found our client sort of wedged in between the wheelchair and the side of the van, again with the I'm not sure what you would call them, restraints that he was secured to, sort of in an odd position. And as he was basically situating him back into the wheelchair, a struggle ensued, and at some point a shank was produced, and obviously the versions differed at trial over what exactly happened, but Officer Claiborne suffered injuries to his face, and so Mr. Ramirez was charged with aggravated assault on a public servant done with that shank. And at trial, just briefly, the first point of error has to do with an improper argument on the part of the state. We believe it was adequately summarized in our brief, but the state made a comment that the one of the prosecution witnesses had said there's no broken wheelchair when she had not testified to that. So the defense objected. The trial court overruled the objection. And again, I won't dwell on that because we think it's adequately briefed. To move on to the errors at the punishment phase, our client was convicted, and the second point of error, the first error committed at the punishment phase has to do with sustaining an objection to the appellant's opening statement, where he said, "I want you to stop and think about why did they proceed in the way that they did." Now, the state claims that this violated a motion in limine. This is apparently based on something that in the pretrial motion in limine, which was granted, that asked the parties to refrain from making comments about the decisional process of the district attorney's office. We don't think that simply asking the jury to stop and think why did they proceed the way that they did came within the purview of that provision of the motion in limine. But assuming for argument's sake that it did, there's case law that says, if I could find this right here, we did not cite to it in our brief, I apologize, but this is responsive to the state's argument. I didn't know what they were going to say. That a motion in limine cannot be used to exclude properly admissible evidence. So it's our position that as long as he was making a statement that was proper in opening statement, It was not objectionable. Even if it did somehow come within the purview of that motion in limine, because we all know a motion in limine is not an evidentiary ruling, it's just a preliminary ruling to try and keep the jury from hearing something without first getting the trial court's permission. And that case I cited, too, that's Goiter v. State, a 2002 case from the Court of Criminal Appeals, quoting Norman v. State, another Court of Criminal Appeals case from 1975. So
what's the cites on those cases, sir?
Goiter is 115 Southwest 3rd 11, and the Penn site there is pages 14 and 15. And it's quoting Norman v. State, which is 523 Southwest 2nd, 669. So, again, it's our position on that, that the motion in limine cannot be enforced to exclude admissible evidence. And we think that, as applied to this case, as long as it was a proper opening statement, it was not objectionable. Moving on to our issue 3, and this is where it gets a little more nuanced. I think issues 3, 4, and 5 are probably the I would say the weightiest issues in our appeal. Issue 3 has to do with a hearsay objection. At the trial on punishment, not the trial on the merits, appellant's twin stepdaughters testified, and just to protect their anonymity, we'll refer to them as KC and MC, as we did in our brief. But basically, Casey testified that he had started molesting her when she was 5 or 6, and she detailed that abuse. Of course, appellant took the stand at the trial on punishment and vigorously denied all of that. And there was, when he took Casey on cross-examination, he asked her about a statement she had made that you're going to get it for what you did to my sister. Apparently, there was something that she had said, communications with her sister. I apologize, Your Honors. The timeline in this case was sketchy, even as it developed at trial. But apparently, sometime in February or March of the year that the girls made these accusations against appellant, their stepfather. They had some conversation, and according to them, they each had separate encounters with him that they felt were inappropriate, but neither of them knew what the other one was claiming he had done to her. So it was this, once they got together and talked about it, that was when they started telling people, reporting the allegations of abuse. And again, I have to stress, he has not been tried, much less convicted, on these other charges of abuse. These were allegations that were made at the punishment phase of trial on the aggravated assault of a public servant charge. Now, basically, the statement, you're going to get it for what you did to my sister, it's our position that this was not hearsay. The state objected to hearsay. The trial court sustained the state's objection. But threats are not hearsay. And there's two schools of thoughts on this. We cited two federal cases in our brief because there appears to be no Texas case on point saying one way or the other that threats are not hearsay or that they are. We're taking the position that they are not. And there's two schools of thoughts on this. One is that the threat is a verbal act, not a statement. That's Tompkins v. Sear, a Fifth Circuit case that we cited in our brief, on page 32 of our brief. The other is that threats are not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. And that's U.S. v. Stratton. That's a Second Circuit case, again, also cited in our brief. But even if it was hearsay, once the state had objected to hearsay, appellant correctly pointed out that she can testify to how she feels. And so we believe that even assuming for the sake of argument that the threat, or this threat, was a single statement, is hearsay, it would be admissible under the state of mind exception in Rule 8033. Now, the state seemed to suggest in their brief that this theory was not advanced at trial, but if you take a look at the record, then the defense clearly said she can testify to how she feels. And the state of mind exception under 803.3 expressly includes a statement of mental feeling. So we think that that argument for admissibility was brought to the attention of the trial court, and therefore it was error for the court to overrule that objection. And I'm sorry, the error for the court to sustain that objection. This was evidence that the defense had offered. Moving on to point of error four, this is another issue that seems to raise an issue of first impression. This concerns what the sexual assault nurse examiner, Teresa Fugate, testified to. On direct, the state had her read aloud from her notes. Initially, when she started testifying to what Casey had told her during the course of her examination, appellant objected to hearsay and specifically stated that he did not believe that everything that she was about to testify to was reasonably pertinent to medical diagnosis or treatment. Trial court overruled that objection. Nurse Fugate then asked if she could read from her notes, and so the state basically said go ahead, and then she started reading, and appellant immediately objected and specifically objected to her reading from a document that's not in evidence. Now, I think from reading the state's brief, we're both in agreement that there is really no Texas case on point that expressly says you should not read from a document that's not in evidence. I cited a treatise written by two of my former law professors, as it appeared to be the most directly on point statement of the law that I could find on this issue. But this does present an issue of first impression. However, the commentary and the case law does seem to be clear that it is improper for a witness to read from a document that is not in evidence. And we feel that the state, although they articulated the purposes of medical diagnosis or treatment impression, this was not just testimony. This was specifically, this was reading from something that was not in evidence and was never offered in evidence after the witness testified. So it was never admitted in evidence. And we feel that that was improper. And again, this is an issue of first impression. So although I can't, you know, there doesn't appear to be a Texas case saying one way or the other, it does seem to be a pretty clear principle of law. And on issue five, we have argued that the state erred in sustaining, or excuse me, the trial court erred in sustaining the state's objection to testimony given by our client when he took the stand in his own defense at the trial on punishment. And he basically, the prosecution had asked him, do you feel that Catherine, that's the mother of Casey and MC and appellant's ex-wife, was maybe, and without getting into anything that was said, kind of instigating things at times. An appellant said, I think this last situation, Catherine was pregnant with Jay's baby, which was a sexual offender that I called and turned in. Now, the objection the state made at trial was non-responsive and outside the record. And we've cited case law in our brief. An objection on the grounds of non-responsiveness it should only result in the exclusion of evidence only if the objection timely and specifically directs the trial court's attention to why, beyond its non-responsiveness, the evidence is inadmissible. In this context, in order to properly exclude evidence or obtain an instruction to disregard, a party must address in its objection both the non-responsiveness and the inadmissibility of the answer. So these cases seem to stand for the proposition that it's not objectionable on grounds of non-responsiveness unless it is inadmissible. And we believe this was relevant and admissible evidence as articulated in our brief. And the state now on appeal, they did not make this argument at trial, but they seem to be arguing that, well, this was irrelevant evidence. And I would call your attention that the trial court did implicitly, it appears, earlier make a ruling on this very same subject matter that we've referenced in footnote 3 of our brief, that they overruled a relevance objection by the state to a similar fact. That's on page 41 of our brief, footnote 3. Really quickly, because I see I'm almost out of time, in issue 6, we basically argued that our client's right to counsel was violated because the state objected and the trial court sustained the objection to an argument he made that they wanted the evidence that they had proved up in punishment to taint the jury's sentence. It seems that this issue, again, if I understand the state's arguments correctly, turns on the, oh, sorry, Your Honor, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Arrington.
May it please the court. I agree with the appellant's counsel, at least to the degree that both sides have adequately briefed the issue in their written briefs. I will touch on only two issues here today. First, I would like to address the second point of error in which appellant now claims that if it were admissible evidence, he should be permitted to comment about it in opening argument without violating the motion or in violation of the motion in limine. And at least to the state, it doesn't really make sense. You can raise the issue without first approaching the bench and request a ruling on the motion for limine, but then you're required to approach the bench and get a ruling later during the, in this case, the punishment phase of trial. The state maintains that at the very least, it should have been incumbent upon a counsel to approach the bench, ask for a ruling on the motion in limine, and then could proceed with opening argument. He didn't do that. We maintained that the trial court's ruling was therefore proper. I should point out, by the way, he never did introduce any evidence to that issue in the punishment phase of trial. He merely commented in opening argument and did not comment about it in closing argument either. So at the very least, it's harmless. Also, we maintain that the trial court's ruling was correct in the second point of error on the not only on the motion in limine, but it constituted argument as opposed to a proper opening statement, i.e., it asked the jury to draw conclusions about evidence when there was no evidence before the jury yet. So for those two reasons, the state maintains that the trial court did not err in his ruling. Finally, as the state has briefed fairly at length, we maintain the error, if any, was harmless. I'd also like to go to the third point of error, which we're arguing over. You're to get it for what you did to my sister. The state maintains that the statement was never authenticated. The witness never testified one way or the other as to whether she made that specific statement. She claimed she made several statements. She admitted she made several statements in defense exhibits 9 and 10. But that particular statement is in neither exhibit. Furthermore, she denied making one of the statements in Defense Exhibit 10. It's a little unclear from the record as to which statement she was talking about. I imagine, I'm just postulating here, that counsel was pointing to a statement and the witness was pointing to the statement and saying, I made these, but I didn't make this one. But they never actually read it out loud properly because it had not been ruled on yet. It had not been properly authenticated yet. So it's a little unclear. I think you can sort of read between the lines, and the statement she probably was denying was, you'll regret what you did to Mariah. I effing hate you. So the statement, as counsel summarized it, is very different, the state maintains, from the statement issue in the two exhibits. As it happens, the witness denied making one statement and never testified one way or the other about the second statement. Therefore, the state maintains it wasn't properly authenticated, so it wasn't not admissible at trial. Furthermore, assuming that the defense offered it for how she was feeling, the error was harmless in this instance because she was permitted to testify at length about how she felt. just a couple of pages later in the record, I couldn't give you the cites off the top of my head, she testifies for three quarters of a page about how she felt at the time and what she felt toward the defendant. So that a statement, a short text statement, couldn't, the ruling against the admission of a short text statement was harmless in the context of the later evidence that was adduced regarding how the witness felt about felt at the time. Unless the court has any questions about any of the other points of error, state.
What about the cumulative argument?
I'm sorry?
The cumulative argument.
Oh.
As I read your brief, you simply say there wasn't any error, so there wasn't anything to accumulate.
The Court of Criminal Appeals has, yes, repeatedly said that you can't have cumulative error from non-error, so that the cumulative error argument as to, if the state maintains there was no error, so you couldn't have cumulative error. Assuming for a moment that you have more than one error, and both those errors are harmless, the court has never addressed that specifically because it's never come up. What they have suggested, or what the Court of Criminal Appeals has suggested, is that cumulative error is still subject to harmless error analysis, i.e., you can't simply say, oh, the trial court erred twice, even though both those errors were harmless, together they must have been harmful. You have to articulate how they were harmful. I understand that's extremely difficult for appellant to do. You'd have to pair up and, oh my God. But it would be incumbent upon this court to not only analyze the two errors, conclude that both are harmless, then take both together and conclude that the two together were harmful in some way. And it would have to be some sort of symbiotic, because he couldn't get into this and you overruled that, therefore he was prevented from presenting, you know, a complete defense in some way or fashion.
Mr. Wilkerson, I'm interested in the aspect of this case that was stated in the state's brief and I believe in the appellant's brief, that Mr. Ramirez was handcuffed to his bed at Petersmith. Now, he's got both legs cut off just above, at least I don't know where the cutoff was. We never did specify if he had knees and the cutoff below the knees, before the ankle, but at any rate, then he was also handcuffed as he was being transported in a wheelchair. Now, is that standard procedure to just handcuff everybody? Or do you handcuff guys that have tried to run off and got run over by a train? Or just what is the procedure for these handcuffs on this prisoner in coming from the hospital and trying to get to the jail?
I believe it is standard procedure. There's nothing that specifically says this is the standard procedure in the record. No witness who testified to this. Several witnesses, particularly the first state's witness, testified that's how she had always done it and how she understood it was supposed to be done. Whether there's any written policy regarding that or not, there's nothing in the record about that one way or the other. Yeah, the first witness several times testified about handcuffing.
Well, I didn't see any statement in any of the briefing that this prisoner had tried to escape once he was arrested at the railroad track, that he ever tried to escape again. And I just was curious about if there was a bit of conduct in advance of this particular incident when he tried to escape and therefore needed to be somehow or another put in handcuffs. He might crawl off down the hall or something.
There's nothing in the record regarding whether there's some sort of heightened procedure for prisoners who have had attempted to escape in earlier or in other instances. Again, I'm probably reading maybe reading too much between the lines of the testimony of the first witness who said that's how she always did it, that they were always, every prisoner she'd ever had always been handcuffed to the bed, and every prisoner she had was either handcuffed by leg restraints to the wheelchair, or in the instance of the appellant because it was difficult to handcuff him by the legs to the wheelchair that he was handcuffed.
There was also a statement in one of the briefs, I can't recall which one, that the jury deliberated for 20 hours in this case. Was that at the punishment phase?
You know, I don't remember. I believe it was at the punishment phase, but I would have to go back and look. Be happy to do a down and dirty letter brief.
That's okay. I can do that. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr. Wilkins.
State police for informants.
May I use his unused time? I'm kidding. I know that's not allowed. But I guess I want to address what he said and some of Your Honor's questions, Justice Meyer. But I feel compelled to just briefly finish where I had to stop myself regarding our sixth point of error on the use of the word taint. That seems to be what this turns on, is whether or not that was counsel for the state seemed to suggest that was a disparaging remark about the prosecutors. We don't think there's any reasonable view of the record that would support the conclusion that any juror could have interpreted that as personally attacking the prosecutors. Just for the sake of this argument, we'll accept the definition offered by the state in their brief that taint means to affect with a tinge of something reprehensible. Well, yes, I mean, that is what prosecutors generally try to do at the trial on punishment, is to show reprehensible character, and in this case, extraneous offense evidence, to try and show the jury that the defendant is a bad person and deserves a harsh punishment. Now, to pick up, so we think it was an entirely appropriate argument, proper jury argument, appropriate characterization of the state's case. To answer Your Honor's question, I would describe appellant's injuries based on the record, and I believe there is a picture of him among the exhibits, his legs as being severed mid-calf, below the knee but well above the ankle. I'm glad you brought up the length of the deliberations at the trial on punishment, because this is why we put in that cumulative error argument. And it is not our position that non-errors, things that are not error, can in their aggregation constitute reversible error, but rather that if this court does find error and finds that the court erred in multiple respects, as argued in our brief, but each error taken by itself is harmless, then the court should analyze the collective harm, the cumulative harm caused by those errors, each of which would be harmless per se. And that is based on precedent we've cited in our brief cases from Texas Supreme Court, Fifth Circuit, and Court of Criminal Appeals. And we think that the reason that that point of error is so important is because, as you notice, we've alleged five separate points of error at the punishment phase. It is probably more difficult to try and do a harm analysis at punishment than it is at the guilt phase because, again, as we said in our brief, of the nebulousness of the jury's decision-making process. The defendant in this case faced a range of punishment of anywhere from 5 to 99 years or life in prison. And so if for example, some of these errors are constitutional and subject to harmless error analysis, some of them are subject to the substantial rights analysis under Rule 44.2b. And the question then would be, did they have a substantial and injurious effect or impact on the jury's decision? Well, if the jury would have given him 20 years instead of 25, then is that but for the erroneously admitted or excluded evidence, or had he been allowed to make that argument, whichever the error is, then is that a substantial and injurious effect or impact? I would argue that if you're the person who has to do those 5 years, then yes, it is. That is a big difference. And so we think the length of their deliberation process and also the fact that they sent out a note, I have never seen this before, but a jury asking if they could give a range of punishment at sentencing, that shows that they clearly struggled over how much time to give this, what punishment to assess. And finally, I guess I would just make an argument on the harm issue, on the harm analysis. The state, in its argument for harmlessness, repeatedly states in its brief that the evidence established that appellant falsely cried out for help in order to lure Deputy Claiborne to stop the van and come back to assist him, and that appellant somehow tricked him into stopping the van by pretending to be hurt. We don't think that a fair reading of the record supports that. In fact, according to Officer Claiborne's own testimony, when he saw the appellant, he said he was sort of wedged between the arm of the wheelchair and that lifting apparatus inside the van. And when I saw that, man, you know, it scared me because he sounded like he was really in pain and I was worried for him. So the state's own evidence seemed to suggest appellant, if he was not seriously injured, then certainly there was some kind of accident. It was not contrived. And so we pray for reversal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Arrington. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your arguments here today. Your case is submitted, and you're free to go about your business. We will remain seated at the bench while the lawyers in the next case move forward.